2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn, 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Malarkey.
It's a nice sunshine out there, and we really weren't expecting too much today. The early morning forecast called for mostly cloudy skies. They've adjusted that, although the weather folks still say there'll be clouds, but we've had a good bit of blue sky and sunshine, and that has pushed the temperatures already up into the mid-40s. It's amazing how when it's been cold, you know, we get up into the mid-40s and it, you know, seems warm, seems tropical. It's really still kind of chilly, but when you're outside, sunshine, mid-40s, not too bad, not too bad. Coming up later on the program today, guests from Butler County Community College will be joining us. But on the first segment of the program today, it's one of those serendipitous things. We were talking, it was about a week and a half ago, I think, when a caller, we were having an open talk segment here on the program, a caller mentioned the World War I truce that happened during Christmas time in France. Germans and British and the French fighting against each other, of course, World War I. 100 years ago, by the way. 100 years ago. And I said, yeah, I've heard about that. I've heard about the Christmas truce. I think I saw a TV special on it or a film clip a few years ago. But lo and behold, I then get an email from historian David Pietruzza, with whom we've chatted before here on the program. And it turns out that he had just delivered a paper at a university on this very subject, the Christmas truce of World War I. So we were able to quickly make arrangements to chat with David Pietruzza, and he'll be our first guest here on the It's Your Turn program. In fact, we're scheduled to hook up with him in just a couple of minutes. So the story of what really happened at the Christmas truce of World War I with historian David Pietruzza. We'll take a quick break. It's coming up next here on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn on WISR. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Howie Pinckney with Pinckney Capital Management in Portersville. Today, many people need help managing their investments. The investment options available today can be confusing. If you would like to talk to someone for help, why not call me for an appointment? Howie Pinckney at Pinckney Capital Management, 1284 Perry Highway, Portersville, Pennsylvania. My telephone number is 724-368-4224. Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC, a registered investment advisor.
Coming up on the It's Your Turn program here on WISR, my name is Dave Malarkey, and we're very pleased to be able to chat once again with historian David Pietruzza about a fascinating story, a heartwarming story. It took place a long time ago, over 100 years ago, during World War I. First of all, David Pietruzza, nice to have you with us again. Good to talk with you.
Good to be back.
We chatted with historian David Pietruzza before, in fact, most recently, on the release of his book on Theodore Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt. But we want to talk today about the Christmas truce in World War I. And I understand, David, that you just delivered a paper on this somewhere?
Yes, a talk at Siena College outside of Albany, New York, and it's an interesting topic. You've seen a lot of remembrances of it in the popular culture. The most recent is an actual opera which won a Pulitzer Prize, and for once the Pulitzer Prize people got it right. Because I saw this opera in production at the Glimmerglass Festival in upstate New York, and I can tell you, at the end of the first act, I was simply awash in tears. It's an incredibly moving story, but people have done things with it from commercials or little videos for Cadbury, or not Cadbury, but British Chocolates, or for Fox Sports News to play up soccer, or going way, way back to my youth, and I just heard it on the radio the other day, a very, shall we say, not exactly factual account, which is called Snoopy's Christmas.
Wow.
Remember that one?
Oh, yes.
Snoopy and the Red Baron?
Yes, yes.
Well, so that's sort of a takeoff on that. So it goes all the way from Snoopy to high opera and commercials for chocolate, British chocolate companies, and everything in between. And a movie not too long ago called Joyeux Noël, which the opera is based very much on. So the story is very much alive in our memory, as it should be, because in the midst of World War One, which was just such a horrible conflict where tens of millions of people died, and then tens of millions of people more died with the flu outbreak after that, the Spanish flu pandemic. It's to have something which shows humanity, which shows this a sense of mercy and of just goodness and decency, even for that brief moment, which was in 1914 December. Then we want to look at that, and we want to have something to give us hope at this Christmas time.
Well, World War One, in large part, was fought by means of what we now call trench warfare, correct?
On the Western Front, and this is a largely a Western Front story. There are smaller outbreaks with the Austro-Hungarians and the Russians, of small truces like that. You see truces throughout history, actually. There's the Truce of God and the Peace of God in the Middle Ages. There's even little truces in the Napoleonic Wars and the Russo-Japanese War. And these are not Christmas truces, but I can, you know, doing this story, it jogged my memory. There used to be a Christmas truce every year in Vietnam.
Huh.
It might be 30 hours, it might be less than a day. I had it in my memory that a fellow who sat in a class with me in high school was killed during one of these truces. It appears to have been a false memory, but maybe he was killed during some other truce. But it's interesting that even with a communist system, the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, there was still some respect for Christmas then.
Speaking of trench warfare, maybe as a historian you can tell some of our
listeners. Trench warfare is important. Mm-hmm. It's important that you raise that, because when these trenches are often very close to each other. The German and the French and the German and the British might be a few hundred yards or less away from each other. So these guys could hear each other. These guys sort of knew each other, you know, day after that. And then the fact that at this Christmas time they were able to yell across to each other, sing across to each other, and really be so near, so proximate, that's a big part of making this work. What's amazing is it's not coming from above, it's spontaneous, it's from the men, and it is not one truce, it's unit by unit by unit for, you know, tens of miles, maybe hundreds of miles, largely British and German, by the way. Not so much British and French. The French are pretty ticked off their country has been invaded and occupied, northern France occupied by the Germans. So they're less amenable to this.
Mm-hmm. I saw a movie about this some years ago, and they depicted the singing of Silent Night, which makes sense to me, because
was that What a Lovely War?
I don't remember the film, but Silent Night was written. I mean, it comes from Germany. Stille Nacht, Stille Nacht.
Stille Nacht. It comes from Austria.
Yeah,
and that is, you know, they're different. Like I say, this is a series of individual truces all along the line. So in some ways, it may have started differently, but the most famous events. Stories are that the Germans start singing Stille Nacht, and the British recognize this as Silent Night, and they answer in English. And then you see, like, O Tannenbaum coming out, and the British might come out with some, oh, it's a long way to Tipperary, or Adeste Fidelis, which is the Germans would be singing Adeste Fidelis in Latin, and the British would be coming back with, oh, come all ye faithful.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the same hymns in different languages, all up and down that line. Before that, what happens the night before is Christmas trees. The German High Command had shipped a whole bunch of Christmas trees, like maybe the kind you'd have in a small apartment, not big ones, mm-hmm. maybe the top of Christmas trees, to the front. And the German soldiers light these up. And the British are, of course, wondering, what the hell is going on? Does this presage an attack? Is this some sort of a trick? And so it's the Christmas trees which even prefigure the singing as a start of this. And so it's all very much tied up with traditional Christmases.
Hmm. Now, you say that this was celebrated on the Western Front. The Eastern Front of World War One in Russia, but they celebrated Christmas at a different time of the year, right? Because they were still using the Julian calendar.
Yes, that was a problem. Earlier in the month, Pope Benedict the 15th called for a Christmas truce. And the Germans immediately agreed to it. The Germans really seem much more into this whole thing than anyone else. They immediately agree, and they say, we'll do it if you guys do it. And the British say, well, okay, but we will leave this up to the French, because it is a Frenchman, a French general, who is in overall command on the Western Front. And they say, no. And so nothing officially happens there. And as you say, on the Eastern Front, there's two Christmases. So which Christmas do you do? I suppose you could do both, but they do neither. And also, that, with the exception of a few big sieges, the situation is just so much more incredibly fluid on the Eastern Front. So you don't have this trench warfare thing. And also think about the time of the year. There's a lot of weather and time of the year involved in making this happen. Armies tend to come to a halt in winter, or at least did, preparing for, like, spring offensive. So things are, like, hunkering down. And also, these trenches are just miserable places. The water table in northern France, which is where the British lines were, tends to be very high. So as soon as you dig a trench, you know, I've seen figures in some areas, you go down a foot and it starts to flood. You go down 3.5 feet, it starts to flood. So these things are like people are walking around in these trenches, getting trench foot in November, December, January 1914-15. More soldiers die from trench foot and gangrene and frostbite than they do from enemy fire. But when Christmas is coming up in 1914, the weather turns colder, which is actually good because the water freezes and you're no longer, you know, schlossing around in these things, and people can move about more. And it's also the snow covers the ground, and it's, you know, as they say, beginning to look a lot like Christmas.
Hmm. We're chatting, listeners, with historian David Pietruzza. A quick break, but we have a couple more minutes to chat with him, so we'll be back here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these messages.
Butler Ambulance Service not only serves the largest portion of Butler County for 911 ambulance response, but they also offer CPR and first aid training classes and are a leader in wheelchair van assistance, too. Butler Assist Coach, a division of Butler Ambulance, provides county residents with medical and non-medical wheelchair van transportation for general doctor visits, shopping, or even transportation to an event. To learn more, visit butlerambulance.com or to schedule a transport, call 724-283-4385. Butler Ambulance Service. Care you can count on.
If you're finalizing your Christmas gift list or maybe wrapping it up, here's an idea. Why not put the Society of St. Vincent de Paul on your Christmas list this year? I'll tell you what, a gift, even a small one, would be most appreciated as they continue this year and in the new year to try to help the needy and the less fortunate in our community. So think about it. It's really nice. And by the way, thanks very much for your support during the past year, and the best of the holiday season to you and yours. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year from the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. Their thrift store in the Greater Butler Mart on Route 8 South. Also the food bank in the Lower Institute Hill area of the city on Monroe Street, North Monroe Street. And, of course, their client aid program as well. We stand tallest when we stoop to help others. Merry Christmas from the good folks at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. You're listening to It's Your Turn here on WISR. I'm Dave Malarkey. David Pietrusia joins us by telephone, and we're talking about the Christmas truce during World War I. Happened in December of 1914. That's the right year, correct? That's early.
Yes.
That's actually pretty early, isn't it, in World War I?
Well, the war starts in August, so it's very early. People thought the war would be over by Christmas, and then they have settled in. The Germans make their big push on the Western Front, as they successfully did in 1870, as they successfully did in 1940, but it doesn't work in 1914, and everything just bogs down. The French fight back in that war. There's the Battle of the Marne, which saves Paris. The government had evacuated Paris. They had gone to Bordeaux. There were plans even to blow up the Eiffel Tower. I'm not quite sure what military value that would have had, but they were in a panic-stricken mode, but everything holds, and then it holds for 4 years with the static trench warfare.
Now, you mentioned that the two sides involved in the Christmas truce were the Germans and the British. Keep in mind, listeners, the United States was not even involved in World War I yet. In fact, we did not get involved in World War I until very late in the war.
1917, April, is when we get in, and then we really don't get involved in the fighting in any meaningful sense for another year. And then we take a bunch of casualties then, but nothing in comparison to what the Western allies or any of the combatants in Europe do.
David Pietrusia is a historian and writer. I am not, although I'm a bit of an amateur historian on World War II. I've pretty widely read there. And I was just reading about the Battle of the Bulge, and this is about the time of the year that started, too, in Bastogne in 1944. And I was reminded in my reading that it was one of the coldest winters that anyone could remember in 1944, which impacted the American troops who were surrounded at Bastogne. Do we have any records about how cold it was during the Christmas truce of World War I, 1914, or did they even keep records?
Well, it got down to freezing because you had the snow. There was you can find this on YouTube. There's an individual sort of Christmas truce story, I think it was narrated by Robert Stack or something, about American soldiers who are lost in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II and go and wander into a farmhouse, which is occupied by the wife of a German army baker. He's not there, but she and her son is there. And these Americans come in, and they are given shelter, which is interesting. But then a bunch of Germans who are lost wander in, and she says there's going to be no shooting. There's going to be a truce at this Christmas. And the Germans actually help minister to a wounded American and make a stretcher for him. And so you even get a bit of a Christmas truce in that same area with Nazis. But in that 1914 truce, what you get is they come across the lines, they exchange presents because the folks in the home fronts in both countries had sent all kinds of things, cigarettes, chocolates, warm clothing, pipes, tobacco, everything to the men at the front. So they have a lot of things to exchange, and they exchange things even like those spiked helmets that the Germans had or buttons from their uniforms. A lot of the Germans had been in Britain before World War I. We think of immigration as well. That's an American thing. 80,000 Germans had been living in Britain before 1914. Many of them as waiters and barbers, and they go back to Germany and fight. Adolf Hitler's half-brother had lived in Britain before, in Liverpool, I believe, before 1914. And so these guys, that's another thing which facilitates that truce, that the Germans, many of them speak English and are very familiar with Britain, and in some ways are homesick for it. They give a British lieutenant notes to take back to a girlfriend. His German has left his girlfriend and his motorcycle in England at the beginning of the war. And another German brings over the papers from a dead British soldier to be returned, personal effects to be returned. Perhaps the most famous image of that truce is the soccer game, football, as they call it, which is games break out along the front, maybe Saxons versus Scots, it becomes a sporting event, and they exchange booze. That's another thing which is exchanged. There's a story of a big keg of beer rolled down by the Germans that they had seized from a Belgian brewery, and they share that with the Brits. So it's really a case of amazing good fellowship. There is a very grisly aspect to this, and there have been truces like this before. One of the reasons why you have a truce is to bury the dead. When you rush the opposition and they die in no man's land, you can't get your comrades, and they are rotting dead bodies littering this no man's land. It's very horrible. So they are able to do that, and in many cases the British or German clergy will help bury the fellow from the other side. So it really is a remarkable story.
You mentioned this no man's land between the trenches, sometimes even just 100 or 200 yards apart. Was there a border? I mean, like, you know, barbed wire or something separating the two sides?
Yes, incredible amount of barbed wire. I saw a figure that 1 million miles of barbed wire was used on the Western Front. Now, of course, you know, there'd be one line of it. There'd be, it would be blown up all the time. The front would be state moving in some way or another. But so there was barbed wire and barbed wire and barbed wire. That's one of the things which makes this a different sort of war. Barbed wire, massive use of artillery, machine guns, later tanks, poison gas, flamethrowers. And, of course, airplanes coming in as well. All these new technologies come from that time period, that war.
Yes, we had never seen any of these weapons previously, certainly not airplanes. And I'm not particularly well-read on World War One, but weren't at least some of the artillery pieces still pulled by horse back in those days?
Oh, horses were really in great use in World War One. I also saw, not connected with this story, but I saw this recently, where most of the stuff we were shipping to Europe during the war was actually feed for horses in the army. Huh. And one of the things that Pershing, Black Jack Pershing, our commander of the American Expeditionary Force, was worried about American forces going in against the Germans, was that we didn't have enough horses. So it's still not quite the modern age. And I've seen also a documentary made by the German army, not by Goebbels, but by the Wehrmacht in World War II, of talking about how they came and conquered the West, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, this whole lead up to Dunkirk. And you see a lot of horses. You see a lot of horses in action, not cavalry charges or anything like that, but hauling stuff, even in World War II.
General Pershing, World War One, and then later we named a tank.
Oh,
after
yeah,
him, right?
A real cavalryman, too.
Yeah. Wasn't there a tank named after him in World War II?
That's right, because he was, I think, called General of the Army and the first fellow to bear that title since George Washington.
So he would have been the Eisenhower of World War One then, right?
Kind yeah, of. And he had practiced for war unlike Eisenhower. Eisenhower had never served in combat physically before that. He was not in World War One. Pershing serves on the western frontier. The reason he's called Blackjack Pershing is because he had commanded black troopers on our western frontier. He also served in pacifying the rebels in the Philippines when we take over that country in the wake of the Spanish-American War. And in the immediate lead up to World War One, or our involvement in it, he leads American troops, and one of his subordinates is George Patton, into Mexico to chase down Pancho Villa in the mountains and the deserts there after Villa invades New Mexico and shoots up a town called Columbus, New Mexico.
Wow, wow. We, of course, had photography and cameras in World War One. Are there any photographs of the Christmas truce, David?
You betcha, as Sarah Palin used to say, which was quite the a bit of a scandal. First off, cameras were banned, not by the official photographers, but were banned in the trenches by the men. They didn't want photographs or being taken and sent homeward and all this. You never know what could be sent back to destroy morale or to give away a position, et cetera, et cetera. This was not always adhered to. And in fact, there was a talk of having the truce extend to New Year's Day. And one of the fellows says that, oh, well, we wanted to do that to see how the photographs came out, okay? So there were these photographs, and they are sent back to Britain, and they are published in the New Year in British newspapers. And the photographs are quite remarkable because you see British and German soldiers standing together. In many cases, they've exchanged like uniform caps or helmets. So again, absolutely remarkable and stupefying if there was not so much documentation of it. And there really is, not just these photographs, not just official reports, but diaries and letters home for something which was so illicit. It's and so wondrous in its unusualness, and it is remarkably well documented. So you can't say, you know, this never happened. This is some fairy story. This is some Walt Disney story. No, it's not. It really happened, and we have maybe more documentation of this than much of life on the Western Front.
Hmm. Well, as you say, it's remarkable. Wondrous, incredible, but greatly ironic, too. Here were these two sides who were, you know, shooting and killing each other, for goodness sakes. And the next thing you know, they're exchanging Christmas presents and beer and singing Christmas songs and during a temporary truce. What happened, by the way, after the truce ended? Because we're still early in World War One. There's a lot more fighting to come.
Well, they keep on fighting and fighting, and all those technological things and all those battles only ramp up in 1915. So the chance for goodwill on Earth and, you know, during Christmas 1915 is a lot less. It's gotten a lot bloodier, and people are less in a mood to forgive and forget, even for a few hours. The British High Command had warned early in December 1914 of the dangers of this. And the dangers of this to commanders in the field is, how do you start these guys up again? And it is difficult. It doesn't, in many cases, just doesn't stop on Christmas Day. And when they start it up again, they are very wary about shooting them, logically, emotionally, to go and shoot guys you've just talked with, you know, 12 hours before.
Yeah.
So they may pretend to shoot at the other side, but they just shoot up in the air and waste ammunition, or they give warnings that they are going to be firing again on the other side. They're very wary about killing their new chums, and they have a lot in common. You know, you think of these reunions of Germans or Americans or Unions and Confederates 50 years afterwards, and there's a great bond between them because they've gone through stuff that, you know, civilians or their home front people or their descendants have not gone through. So they have that bond. So even in the trenches of 1914, these guys have this bond of this horrible life that they have been undergoing now for a couple months.
I've been blessed to have the opportunity to visit Normandy and many of the battlefields of World War II, the Normandy Peninsula, Utah Beach, Omaha, and so on. There are, and I'm sure you know this, David, there are monuments and memorials all over Normandy about, you know, such and such a battle was here, even small skirmishes like La Fayette outside of St. Mary Glace. There are all kind of monuments and memorials there. You'll be driving along a country road in France in Normandy, and all of a sudden there'll be a monument to, you know, something that happened there. My question is, are there any monuments to the Christmas Truce from World War I?
There is a museum in that area, World War I Museum, but in the last few years, I think maybe at the 100th anniversary of this, a specific monument was enacted in northern France, and I think a member of the British royal family took part in that. So it is very well remembered in that part of the world.
The Christmas Truce,
and of course, it would be very much more remembered to the nationalities, to the nations that took part in it, and of course we didn't.
Yes.
So our memory of it is, you know, sort of as a bystander.
Yeah, very good point. Yeah, the Christmas Truce of 1914, during the early stages, really, of World War I. Maybe you've heard about it. Now you know the true story. Now you know what really happened during that Christmas truce. Thanks to David Pietrusia, historian who recently delivered a paper on this topic, and very nice to chat with you today. I do want to remind listeners about your latest book, David, on Theodore Roosevelt. Can you talk about that for just a second here as we wrap up?
Yeah, that's called TR's Last War, Theodore Roosevelt, the Great War, i.e. World War I. So we're in that neighborhood again, and a journey of his journey of triumph and tragedy. And it tells his story about urging preparedness for that war, trying to get into that war, and what happens to his sons. And they all end up on that Western Front that we've been talking about.
David, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for being with us here today.
Thank you.
Sure. So long now.
It's winter supply month at Osterling's Lawn and Garden. Stop in for heated waterers for rabbits to livestock, Lignetics wood pellets, heaters for bird baths, muck boots, Nebo flashlights and oil lanterns, and hand and foot warmers too. Get ready for the snow with Pet Safe Ice Melt, rock salt, calcium chloride flakes or pellets, snow shovels, and ice scrapers. You can find it all at Osterling's Lawn and Garden at the corner of Monroe and Jefferson Streets in Butler.
Start spreading the news as the legend of Sinatra lives on. Join WISR this year for an evening with Sinatra on Thursday, December 13th. This dinner dance will be held at the Tanglewood Center with music provided by the Vince Tavolario Quartet. And Vince and the crew will resurrect those famous shows from Christmas time at Natilli's as well. And we'll have Italian food stations created by Chef George. Tickets are just $25 and are available at the WISR office at 252 Pelo Street, Natilli's Restaurant, and the Tanglewood Center. As always, it's BYOB. A basket raffle and other fundraising will benefit the March of Dimes, so come celebrate the holiday season and the chairman of the board on Thursday, December 13th at the Tanglewood.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea.
Welcome back. What a great story. And, you know, we got the true facts there from historian David Pietrusia about the Christmas Truce of World War I. Fascinating story. Well, we move on to the next segment of our It's Your Turn program today, and we're very pleased to talk once again with the president of Butler County Community College, and that's Dr. Nick Neupower. Dr. Neupower, good to see you.
Hi, David. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, nice to see you. And also we welcome Jess Matnock, who's the Executive Director of Communications and Marketing. Jess, good to see you as well.
You too, Dave.
And thanks for bringing the sunshine with you today.
Yes,
sure.
Came in.
We were just chatting as I brought them into the studio. The forecast early this morning was for mostly gray and cloudy, and we've been kind of pleasantly surprised with quite a bit of blue sky. And, you know, it's in the mid-40s, and it feels like it's 70 degrees
Absolutely.
Out there because
yeah.
it's been so cold for so long. Well, let's see. Here we are, December 13th. Is the fall semester ended? Finals are done? Yes?
Yes, wrapping up this week.
This week, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. I talked to a student at Slippery Rock University a couple of days ago, a young man who's got an interesting biology project replacing all the diseased trees along Main Street
yeah.
in Slippery Rock. And I said, well, thanks for chatting with us. I got to go. I'm studying for my last final.
yeah.
Took me back a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But even though it's, or soon will be, the end of the semester and a break time, BC3 hums along. You have a very, very busy winter session, I guess you call it, right? Winter
we
session?
We do. We have a 5-week online winter session, and that starts December 17th.
Which is this coming Monday.
Which is this yeah. coming Monday, yeah. Mm-hmm. So as soon as finals wrap up for the fall, then the winter session starts that Monday. And then our students come back for the spring semester beginning January 14th. Mm-hmm. That's when Session 1 and Fast Track 1 start.
I understand that there are a sizable number of students who are attending other schools, Dr. Neupower, mm-hmm. Whether it's, you know, Clarion, Penn State, mm-hmm. University of Illinois, I don't know, but they're home for the holidays, and they take advantage of some free time to pick up some credits at BC3.
Yeah, and that is a model, I would say, even since Jess has been in college, and certainly for you and I. Of course, when you were at Penn State, you were on a trimester,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was three tens?
Three tens, 10-week, 10-week trimester. There was actually four of them,
huh.
but almost everybody went to for three.
Okay.
He went fall, winter, spring, and then you worked
yeah.
during the summer one to make enough tuition money to come back again.
Yeah. But
there were some kids who didn't have any financial concerns, and they would just go all four quarters, and of course they
wow.
could finish up in short order. It took them 3 years to get a bachelor's degree.
So for Jess and I, for probably most of the listeners, the traditional model, fall, 15 weeks and finals, spring, 15 and finals, and then a summer session. And certainly, again, the model would be that you would perhaps work during the holiday break in December to January and then work and take classes in the summer. That's certainly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And now when the 21st century high-tech, instantaneous technology at your fingertips, that's no longer the model. And while our core is still a fall and a spring, we have about 4 or 5 different offerings within each of the fall and the spring semester, as well as approximately 3, 4, or 5 different types of summer sessions, a 3-week session, a 6-week, an 8-week online. And one, we checked the numbers out this morning, and if I recall, we have about 160 ballpark students who are signed up with a little time to go for our winter session. And it can be used in one of two capacities. One would be exactly as you described. You're coming home for the holiday. You want to catch up. The very low and affordable tuition from BC3,
mm-hmm.
and you transfer. Or it could be an opportunity that you want to catch up. Theoretically, you would think that associate degrees, as an example, would be a nice and easy 60 credits. 15, 15, 15, and 15. It's not necessarily that way. I know our nursing program, my goodness, I think is up around 70 as an example. And there are some other programs that could be 65. So you need to utilize some of these winter sessions, summer sessions, or have a heavier course load. My preference was always to have a course load in the fall or spring when I was a student of ballpark about 15. But I did like utilizing the summers to catch up some. And ironically, that's exactly what our daughter is doing. She's taking an online class from BC3 this semester, and I believe 13 or 14 credits from IUP. You total the two together, you get about the 17 credits, and she'll be taking a winter intercession to catch up also.
I never took an online course, obviously. How do you take tests when you're doing an online course? I mean, are you still at home? What's to keep you from the textbook open right beside yeah. you there? If you're, I mean, is it the honor system or Does it vary from professor to professor?
I'm sure it does. We use Blackboard as our kind of management for an online course.
Is that an internet program or
platform,
or something?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Well, there's it's a very good question. And as time has gone on, just like anything else, it's tightened and improved. Let me give you some examples. The old model when we started on internet would be you had to come to campus for a midterm and final.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's no longer the model. We have Respondus Lockdown, which is a way of ensuring that it's Nick and Jessica who are taking the test on the other line. There's also the opportunity now where cameras as part of your computer, your laptop, to see that it's Dave who's taking the test. There's also technology that will allow, through the technology, we'll be able to evaluate the rhythm that you have with your keystrokes and the way that you type. Think of that. Then whenever you are responding to an exam, it examines that type of thing.
I never thought about the camera. I mean, you know, not that I'm a cheater, but
yeah.
I never thought about having somebody else take a test for you. But with the camera, obviously,
yeah.
And, you know, you could tell also if someone's looking through reference material. Mm-hmm. By, you know, because you can see them.
Well, and the other point with that, though, is that there are various types of assessment. So it could be writing. It could be a presentation utilizing the technology. I've been told that just assume what goes on in a traditional classroom can be done in an internet format. So group presentations, individual presentations, writing papers, assessments that involve the open book, assessments that are timed assessments mm-hmm. that don't necessarily give you the opportunity to go through your notes. There's the opportunity to see that it's you with the camera taking the test or the keystroke technology. There's also further technology just like the cell phone, where and we don't use this at the college, but the way you log in is through your fingerprint and to make sure that it is you. So it's been incredibly reliable. Yesterday's night class has been replaced by today's internet class. What we found is that our students very much like to mix and match. So whereas when we were in school, we had the Monday, Wednesday, Friday class and then the Tuesday, Thursday class. Now it could be the Monday, Wednesday, Friday and then the two online courses. In your mind, conceptually, you're taking them on a Tuesday and Thursday. And, of course, because the bulk of our students, we have a high percentage of students who still work while they go to school, the internet classes work incredibly well for them.
What about the profs? Do they prepare a syllabus that then goes out to the online student? And it's pretty much the same thing if you took it one year from another. I mean, the professor doesn't actually have to be online, obviously.
So there's synchronous and asynchronous, and asynchronous is basically, it's remarkable. It's not, and in the early days, we had professors who would still teach online as if it were a face-to-face class, Tuesday and mm-hmm. Thursday from 2 o'clock. That's not what an online class is. You have your assignments that allow the students the opportunity to log in. You give the deadline. Certainly, they use the syllabus very much the same way that they do in the face-to-face classes. And very much like when you start in a face-to-face capacity, it's probably a little bit rougher to get it up and going. But then as time goes on, you make tweaks. The beauty of utilizing the technology, and millennials and centennials, Gen Z love this, it's the three-dimensional component of the teaching. So in a traditional classroom, if I'm talking about Ivy Lee and the Rockefeller family with the Ludlow Massacre in 1914 in Ludlow, Colorado, I'm giving that in a lecture capacity. When you utilize the technology at the click of a mouse, you can, in a three-dimensional way, bring them to research articles that have been written on it. Videos that have been written on it, and it very much is suited for today's generation, for millennials and centennials. That's how their mind thinks, whereas you and I read a newspaper in a linear fashion. These individuals are authenticating on the spot, and by utilizing the bells and whistles as part of our Blackboard model, they're able to do this.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with the president of Butler County Community College. For those of you who might be joining us a little bit late today, Dr. Nick Neupower is here along with Jess Matnox. She's the executive director of communications and marketing. I have to ask you about the big storm the week before Thanksgiving and how it affected the community college. I'm still getting, you know, I've had guests come in over the past week, and everybody's still sharing their horror stories, you know, about how many days were you out, you know, how many days were you out. And you know, for many people, it was five, six.
Yeah.
There were tens of thousands of people out of power for 6 days. What happened at the college campus, the main campus of BC3? Were you out?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were out. We'll go over this chronologically. So the Thursday morning, we were about the only institution to run on a delay. On Thursday, it was a 9:30 delay. Mm-hmm. And actually, the pickle gate, the Lindora, it was awful. There were accidents. We had some faculty members or some individuals that had an accident, but that bought us some time. And then as the day went on, and actually it was out and about, Brian Opitz and I connected and seemed to think that we were okay for the evening classes. Then, boy, about 3 or 4 o'clock, that ice storm hit. What was unique was that my office, maybe just as a result of being in the chair for as long as I have, there were other school districts and even colleges or universities who were calling to see what it was that we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about technology. We were scattered. A number of us were not on the main campus. I was in Cranberry. Brian was out and about, not quite sure where Jess was. But we have an excellent emergency, proactive crisis model where we connected, and after the decision has been made through cell phone technology, we put the campus alert out that evening classes were canceled, the college was closed. Jessica contacts the media, we send emails, we put it on our website. We do a very good job. Generally doesn't hit everybody, but if someone misses it, it's because they're not signed up for our emergency mm-hmm. texting or listening to the media. You head into Friday morning, and Brian and I made the call very early Friday morning, and it was, as you know, an incredibly serious situation Friday. And what complicates matters for us is that we're not one location. There are different weather patterns in Brockway and Ford City than there are in Butler or Cranberry. If you specifically look at our main campus, the trees, the beauty of our main campus with the trees. Another variable is we need to make a decision super early because our students in nursing are out on the road for clinicals at a very early hour. If I'm not mistaken, when we went into that Friday, we were one of the very first to call. And then we were one of the first to call the closing of the campus on Saturday. As Brian and our staff came on campus, it was a disaster zone. There were trees everywhere. We had power that was out in certain buildings. We lost food in the Pioneer Cafe, our hospitality lab, our bookstore. There was a problem with generators. And, of course, we didn't necessarily know if the AC and the heating would end up going back on because there was this break in service. Incredibly serious situation. But our model with my background and working closely with Jess is that we keep everybody in the loop along the way. We were sending campus emails throughout that weekend. We were communicating via text. I communicated with the trustees, had phone calls. And to our credit, Brian Opitz and his staff, IT, our campus police, while these folks had their power that was off at home, they sacrificed that part of their lives and came to campus and had the campus cleared. Now, we did not know Sunday when the power would come back on. And when we connected early Sunday morning, we thought there was a very good chance that we could be out that Monday or Tuesday. Then we had Thanksgiving break. And I believe that the power on our main campus ended up coming on about Sunday at about 1 o'clock or so. Again, very serious situation where other organizations and schools use the Monday and the Tuesday to start their cleanup. We actually did that that particular weekend, which made a world of difference.
So you were back in session on Monday, back in class.
Yeah.
It was a short week. Because
it was a short week. That's mm-hmm. a great point.
But just Monday and Tuesday, we were able to.
Yeah, because Thanksgiving was that week. Well, there were some schools in the area who were down right through Thanksgiving break.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it was Montauk was one. Because they just didn't, their buildings didn't have any power, and nothing they could do, you know.
And we were lucky. No trees went through buildings. In my time, we've had two of those. The old Armstrong Lodge and the Social Sciences Building. Mm-hmm. And we know this. What complicated matters was the weather pattern in the fall. The trees still had leaves, and it just made everything so much heavier.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, we still have trees that are down on campus. And interestingly, today being a nicer day, our maintenance staff is clearing some of the leaves that normally it would have in the fall, but because of the weather, couldn't get to it. We're estimating damage. We did lose some food. We had to bring the people in to help with the tree removal. But when you're in a situation like that, you're competing with every other homeowner and business and organization for those services. So for the most part, we remained unscathed. But I'll tell you, according to Brian Opitz, it was probably the most serious weather situation we've had in my 12, 13 years as president.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, at the college level, you're able to make it because you only missed a day and part of another day. And professors would be able to make that up, reschedule classes and that sort of thing. You don't have to worry about adding extra days or to the semester or anything like that.
Well, and you utilize the technology. So the same technology that we've talked about, you can make up assignments that way too.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a break. We'll talk more with our guests from Butler County Community College here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR in just a moment or so. One of our sponsors on the program today is Gone Postal Butler. Hey, if you've got packages to mail out at the last minute to friends or relatives for holiday gift giving, Gone Postal Butler. They're located just off Newcastle Road behind Kings and Villa Grande Restaurant, and they package your items for shipping. It's as simple as that. Now, you can ship it any way you want, UPS or FedEx or U.S. Postal Service, your choice. They'll pack it up and ship it. I've utilized their services. It's fast. It's very reasonably priced. It's very convenient. Check it out. Gone Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Great for shipping holiday packages. It seems to me, within the past, I don't know, week or so, we had a news story about additional articulation agreements with Slippery Rock University. Am I remembering that correctly, Dr. Neupauer?
Yes, and mentioned it before. Residents should realize that of Pennsylvania's 32 public institutions, two are in Butler County.
Mm.
Of course, there's 14 community colleges, 14 state universities, and the four state relateds. And a lot of our students come to BC3 and transfer. And the number one transfer institution, of course, probably of little surprise, is Slippery Rock University. And we did have a signing of several agreements. Great meeting hosted by President Barry. And I may want to mention for the listeners in the audience, I'm very impressed with Bill. I think that he'll do a great job at Slippery Rock University. Very community-oriented and understands the value of a partnership with BC3. And that particular event, there weren't only administrators, presidents, provosts, vice presidents, but there were also faculty members. And incredibly important for the faculty members to get to know one another so that you see that the quality matches on paper and the learning outcomes all line up. But it really does add a level of depth when you get to know your colleagues at the respective institution. So a nice signing and a big deal. Students can save lots and lots of money.
Now, I was aware that there were already some existing articulation agreements. The new ones are for different courses. Is that or different areas of study? Is that what happened?
Yeah, go ahead, Jess.
The new ones lead to a bachelor's degree. So the five new ones are petroleum and natural gas engineering, park and resource management, physical activity and fitness management, philanthropy and nonprofit management, and then the fifth is registered nursing.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings us now to 32 formal agreements with Slippery Rock that lead from associates to bachelor's, or our credits transfer into that to receive that bachelor's from Slippery Rock.
And the whole purpose, just for people who don't understand what we're talking about here, an articulation agreement, a student can take a class in one of these areas at BC3, and assuming they pass, that those credits will automatically transfer whenever they go later to Slippery Rock University. The two schools have talked about it.
Yeah.
They realize that it's legitimate coursework, and you know, if you pass it at BC3, it's going to count on your transcript at
SRU. Well, and even to take that model a level further, and I think this is an important clarification, you're correct. Courses are analyzed, but the beauty of their relationship with Slippery Rock is that it is not course to course. It is program to program.
Oh.
So what that means is that let's say there is a course that isn't necessarily in the Slippery Rock catalog for the baccalaureate degree, but based on the learning outcomes and the competencies that those students achieve by successfully completing the associate's degree at our place, they just go in junior standing. Mm-hmm. And again, that speaks to a wonderful collaboration with Slippery Rock. And oftentimes I'm asked questions about student debt, and frankly, I see student debt not that much different than any other choice that we have as adults and grown-ups. We have choices to make, and if an individual wants the overall four-year college experience at an expensive liberal arts institution, then absolutely have at it. But if a student would want to knock down costs and come out debt-free, you can certainly do that. And if you're a Butler County resident and you opt for this agreement, I'll tell you, you will be saving tens of thousands of dollars. And that's what makes this so special.
A lot of background work would have to be done then if this is program to program involving faculty and staff at both institutions.
Yeah, I think the beauty of it is the efficiency, because when you know that a program will transfer right into another program and you plan that from the start,
mm-hmm.
you're taking the right classes in that pathway to get there.
Yes.
That's another way I think that you're saving, not just with our affordable tuition rate, but also knowing the exact steps you need to take in order to accomplish your end goal. You won't be taking classes that might not necessarily be applicable.
Correct. So, Dave, actually, your description, that's kind of the maturation of this whole process. So it did used to be course to course.
Mm-hmm.
But now we don't even entertain an idea for an articulation agreement if it's course to course. And frankly, we have agreements. Remember, we offer those baccalaureate degrees on our campus where it's a 3+1 model. So you earn your two-year associates. The senior institution allows you to take your junior year, our classes, at our tuition rate. And then they'll come in their senior year and offer the 400-level courses. So what used to be the 1, 2, 3, and 400-level course, in some ways that's gone away, and it tracks back to the outcomes from the program. And then if you would analyze those program outcomes in concert with what is offered for outcomes at the course level, that's why, again, it's not necessarily the level of the course as much as it is the competencies. And some of these senior institutions who offer the programs on our campus allow our students 3 years at our place. In essence, you're taking your junior year at BC3 at our tuition and our classes.
There are a number of other schools with which the community college has articulation agreements in place, right?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
lots.
Rather a long list, actually.
Yeah, and we do a very good job. As a matter of fact, I think that's something that's improved over the years of marketing this. We allow these institutions space at our open houses, and we want parents and students to know that this can be part of a proactive plan.
Let's talk a little bit about the community college's role in a unified approach for economic development in Butler County. This is an area that, a topic that you first broached, a couple of years ago when we chatted at New Power.
Believe it or not, in some ways, it's about a decade, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
This started with Commissioners Kennedy, Pinkerton, and Lockheiser. And I believe there was funding from Senator Mary Jo White, and there was a model that was proposed. and for various reasons didn't necessarily take off. And then we had an anonymous donor who allowed the college to work with, after an RFP process, work with Delta, actually work with Fourth Economy out of Pittsburgh to go forward with a model to bring all of these different entities in the county together for a unified approach with economic development. And while that didn't play out exactly as the study had indicated it would, the new Board of Commissioners, the current Board of Commissioners, did take components. And one of the key components was hiring a chief of economic development. And Mark Gordon is a phenomenal person, a man of great integrity, great vision. And working with the BC3s, tourism, chamber, Cranberry Township, CDC, Workforce Career Link, housing redevelopment, and probably missing some. Actually, John Paul also with transit, bringing all of these players together and working toward a common goal, common vision, working on grants together, not necessarily competing, and with the blessing of the county commissioners and in concert with all of these different groups, coming up with this unified approach to economic development. I think that it's already working. I think the announcement for the recent $20 million grant for the expansion of 228, I think, would be an example of this. And we continue to work, and we will have some kind of a public launch that the county and Mr. Gordon will roll out in the spring semester for the formal branding, mission, vision statements, et cetera, so that folks know this is what we're doing. Probably the best way to equate this to something would be Allegheny Conference. So just envision the Allegheny Conference, and that's what we're working toward in Butler County.
I've had Mr. Gordon on the program to meet him and find out about his mission. He's very impressionable guy, that's for sure. Dr. Neupower was the keynote speaker at the Elwood City Chamber annual dinner. That's your home territory, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yeah. Yes, it is. I'm glad you remember that. I love doing this. This is going on 13 years we've been doing this, which I don't know who is 13 years some kind of record. We're going to need to look into that. Tom Tenhove was president for 14 years. And Tom was on your show a couple of
yeah when he was I think he came back for a commencement or something like that.
Yeah.
Wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And part of a 21st century president is about out and about friend making, government relations, fundraising, and representing the college. This show has been such a great platform for that over the years. Speaking as a keynote speaker also speaks to that. So it was special because it was my hometown. We have a unique entrepreneur program that we're partnering with CCBC that we're offering in Elwood City. Of course, Elwood City's a bit in between our Newcastle location, our Cranberry location, and our main campus location. So students from Elwood City have a choice of those three BC3 locations. And just talked about the power of team and togetherness and collaboration. Those are certainly key variables in the 21st century. So, again, love doing that type of thing, and it was quite an honor in Elwood City.
Nice to go back to your hometown. To
yes, it is.
Yes, to speak. You also, along with the Vice President of Finance at BC3, Jim Roboski, were invited to speak at a conference charting the role of community colleges in the future of higher education, invited by Moody's. Who's Moody's?
Yeah, so Moody's is, among other things, an agency which rates the worthiness of organizations, institutions, higher ed institutions for bonds for their, and they give ratings for their.
And it goes up and down.
And it does go up and down.
Yeah.
And interestingly, Dave, ours as a college went down a few years back. You recall when we had the year and a half where we didn't get state funding?
Mm-hmm.
That's how it works. You know, we get funding from the state, and while I don't believe that our capital investment and bond obligation from the state was at risk. Certainly that had a great impact on our operating. Again, we were a year and a half without funds. So that was one of the main reasons why we had a bit of a downgrade. But in these very unique times for higher education, stiff competition, declining enrollments, high school graduation rates declining, contractual obligations, you name it, Moody's has noted how well we run our shop and our finances at BC3. And Jim and I were invited to the Eastern Association of College and University Business Officers annual meeting in sunny Buffalo. And we presented and talked about what's unique about our approach, and I think probably the biggest reason is why Moody's invited us, is that our strategic plan consists of financial benchmarks that we hold ourselves accountable to, that we want this percentage that would go towards a deferred maintenance fund, capital fund for our particular operating costs. And we really emphasize that again to the point where it is in our strategic plan. We were honored to speak not only to community college folks, but also college and university professionals, and it seemed to go over very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Moody's, if you're, whether you're a municipality, a city, a school district, or whatever, if you're going to float a bond issue, you know, if you want to replace a roof or build a new building or renovate a school building, you have to be very cautious about your Moody's rating, because you won't get as good a deal if your bond rating goes down. We need to take a break. We'll stop for a minute and pick up our conversation here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
Have you been keeping up with your Armco Credit Union Christmas Club contributions this year? If not, that's okay, because they can help you manage those holiday expenses. The Armco Credit Union is offering holiday loans with a low 9.5% fixed APR, which comes with a 12-month term, meaning your holiday expenses will be paid off by next year. Take advantage of this offer now through December 31st. Learn more at armcocu.com. Armco Credit Union is an equal opportunity lender and is federally insured by NCUA.
Visiting with us on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn today, the president of Butler County Community College, Dr. Nick Newpower, and Jess Matnock is also here. She's the executive director of communications and marketing. So you're also a featured presenter in a webinar series. not a seminar, but a webinar.
Yeah. Yeah, I look at this and think, how in the world am I squeezing this this all in? But I, yes, I was, along with a president from Virginia and a fundraiser associated with Convergent, which helps colleges and universities with fundraising. And
is this like a podcast that someone can tune into at will? Is that what it is?
Well, there's a live component, and then it is recorded. And actually, there were about 110 people who were signed up for mine. So I was blown away by that. And talk about utilizing the technology. I worked with I took a day at home and did the research and put the content together. Then I touched base with an instructional designer from Convergent who presented it and dolled it up and made it look really nice and pretty, lack of a better term, in a PowerPoint type thing. And then I was able to be broadcast from my office so they could literally see my mug, my face, hear me. And then as I presented the webinar, again, in a sort of a PowerPoint presentation, folks were able to type in questions while I was talking. There was a moderator and a facilitator. The model was that I would talk for about 40 minutes and then would save 20 minutes for questions. The moderator, a facilitator, ended up reading those questions that were typed. I really enjoyed the experience.
That's interesting. Was it the first time you did that?
First time I actually delivered a webinar like that. Hmm. And I guess another component, and Jessica and her staff did a great job of hooking me up with this. I'm now a member of LinkedIn, and the individuals who are part of the webinar have an opportunity to stay in touch with me, utilizing LinkedIn, a bit of a Facebook type approach for professionals. We're able to share information. I'm able to mentor them and stay in touch with them, because after all, there is a definite need for leaders in college and university space. and this was specific for community colleges. I think I mentioned previously that according to the League for Innovations, average tenure for a community college president is just under 3 years. The average age keeps going up. There's an expected turnover either of 25 or 33% of presidents within the next 5 years, I believe. And again, we keep talking about population. If the end size is declining, there's not as many people in the pipeline for these jobs. And we wanted to present the good, the bad, and the ugly pursuing a leadership position as a community college president. The audience was diverse, from colleges and universities, sitting presidents, vice presidents, faculty members. I was surprised by the different types of folks who participated. In the end, I just absolutely loved doing it.
Did you have to have someone in your office with you, or did they just set up a camera, or how did you do it?
Yeah, but believe it or not, the technology, the camera is not even is about the size of a golf ball. It is on my desktop. Interestingly, talking about the ice storm, I presented. I was to present at Community College of Allegheny County's Leadership Institute, talking about strategic communication and as it relates to generational differences. I called my contact at CCAC in Pittsburgh, did not get hammered like we did. This was the Friday that we were referencing earlier. I said, I can't make it. She said, no problem, sent me a link. I clicked on the link, it downloaded everything on my laptop, and from home in my basement, I was able, through a laptop, able to present the PowerPoint. They were able to see me, able to ask questions, completely unbelievable. And while I love the face-to-face, when you utilize technology like this as a tool, not as a substitute, but as a tool, I do think the opportunities are endless.
Are community colleges in other parts of the country experiencing some of the same problems that we are here? I just see we had a news story this morning that the South Butler County School District is the latest one to they've hired a consultant to do a $16,000 study on demographics. They want some hard figures on enrollment projections in the coming years for South Butler. And, you know, that's one of the growing areas of Butler County. But they're concerned about budgeting and staffing without just taking a guess, you know, on what their enrollment's going to be. Most school districts, public school district enrollment is dropping.
Yes.
And that, of course, over the course of time affects you at the college.
The other variable that impacts us, of course, is a good economy. We went over that. Jess, you gave a great presentation yesterday. And what it showed, our adult population, we had a decent number in about 10, and now our adult population has gone down significantly.
We used to have more traditional age students, but it equates with the economy, like how many jobs are out there.
So the number of adult students at PC3 is not as high as it used to be. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
The other point is our students are not going – this is a general statement. Our full-time enrollment is declining. Mm-hmm. Sign of a good economy. You have a job and you take part-time.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the paper this morning. Our enrollment for the fall semester is down 3%. I'll go back to answering your original question. Actually, with our sister community college institutions – a 3% enrollment headcount, it's not a bad number. BC3 and Slippery Rock have really weathered the storm quite well over the years. I think you know that, and your listeners know that. Slippery Rock is down. National weekly publication, Chronicle of Higher Education, of all the universities, not community colleges, but universities across the country, of the 10 who have had the most significant enrollment decline in the last 10 years or so, Cheney is number 2, and Clarion is in that top 10 list.
Mm-hmm.
The state universities, their overall enrollment has gone from about 121,000 down to 98,000. It is impacting everyone, and your point that you bring up, you build a budget based on this expected revenue that is coming in, and you don't have that, what do you have to do? So we have really done a great job of working with vacant positions. We don't fill them. If we fill them, we fill them in a very different way. You know, when benefits are costing an organization $25,000 for full-time benefits, and then you throw the salary on top of that, when we've had retirement incentives, and we've had retirements, I think big number of retirements in two of the last 3 years, that has really helped us. In addition, of course, although this is under the foundation with the great fundraising that we've done. So I do think it's not only something that impacts BC3, community colleges, and certainly across the state with universities, but literally across the country.
I saw a story earlier this year, a few months back, about Edinburgh is another school that's lost significant student population over the last decade. They, early this year, eliminated a number of majors, for lack of a better term, programs. But then they added some new ones.
Yeah.
Not as many, but really diverse things like forensic anthropology, fermentation science. They've got a major now in brewing. Well, the number of craft breweries is exploding.
Yeah.
So not a bad idea. But that's the approach that Edinburgh is taking to try to stabilize things at that school.
So Edinburgh is an institution, and I might be off by one or so here. My 12, going on 13 years and 20, Edinburgh's had about 8 presidents. And Mr. Steffler has always emphasized that you know, the longer that you have a leadership team in place and a vision and a strategy is approved and vetted, then you can work toward that. And I think what's going on in the downtown and the impact we're having there is a great example of that. And when you have constant turnover in your president and you're bringing in new people, each president, rightfully so, wants to bring in a new vision, a new strategy. Mm-hmm. And you no sooner go ahead and then you have a new person coming in, you head in a new direction. And I wasn't didn't exactly know what Mr. Steffler meant early on, but blessed by a great board and great executive team is that I think that in part that we've been able to do a lot of wonderful things because we've had that level of consistency and not much turnover.
Butler County Community College wins the President's Cup. What? Sounds like a sailboat race. It's not like America's Cup, I take it. What's the President's Cup?
The President's Cup is an acknowledgement, an award of giving the top presentation that culminates a leadership institute. It's between three schools. It's Butler County Community College, the Community College of Beaver County, mm-hmm. and Westmoreland County Community College. Each college sends some of their professionals to this leadership development, professional development program. And the curriculum is based off of competencies that are set forward by the American Association of Community Colleges. Really, it was developed in response to there being a decline in leadership, like less people to take on these roles, and how do we prepare the future leaders. And the three community colleges, they saw that challenge, and they responded by building this program, and our president was instrumental in doing that, in building the program up. So I was actually in the first class of the Leadership Institute, and it was a tremendous experience. My team presented our capstone presentation, and we won the first President's Cup, competing again against Beaver and Westmoreland.
What's the capstone initiative?
So the capstone is at the end of all of the sessions, when we've completed the curriculum, the cohort has completed the curriculum, each team, each community college works on a project that uses all of the competencies that they've learned throughout the institute. They pick a topic that is that really should be on their strategic plan mm-hmm. at their respective community college, and they do the research, and they write a paper, and they put together a presentation showing their research and their proposal to meet some of these challenges that we have at the community college. So,
where'd you go for this? Was it
the capstone presentations and the graduation ceremony was at Treesdale Country Club, mm-hmm. but the sessions throughout the institute are held at each community college. Mm-hmm. So we bounced around from Butler, Beaver, Westmoreland, so everyone's able to see everyone else's home base. Yeah.
Which is important. Frankly, we rely on our professional relationships for the speakers, so we match the competencies. And as an example, we had a session on strategic communication, so we talked about government relations, fundraising. In Jess's area would be an example, sessions on diversity. It has really blossomed into something that's incredibly special. Jess was part of a cohort that their capstone project was for there to be a health clinic on BC3's main campus. And as we are making plans for the Victor K. Phillips Nursing and Allied Health Building, that is incorporated. This year's group focused on food insecurity, so a community garden, a food pantry on our main campus, as well as linkages to the curriculum, since agriculture is so important here in Butler County, that would tie to curriculum that would help with this food insecurity issue, the food desert that is the city of Butler, as well as this food pantry. So yes, in addition to being back-to-back number one community college, we are back-to-back winners of the President's Cup.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to ask you, this is different from winning the Best Community College honor 2 years in a row, right? This
Correct.
Looks something
it is
different.
Different, yeah.
Well, if you're talking about food security, I would suggest what they did, I think it was the University of North Carolina. Is that where they put in the bacon vending machine during finals week? Did you see that story?
I have. Yes, I have.
It was last weekend, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was so popular that it filled up every 3 hours.
Wow.
Students were buying it like crazy. A bacon vending machine.
Yeah.
Amazing. We have to check lottery numbers. We'll do that very quickly. We'll be back to wrap up our conversation here on the Thursday edition of It's Your Turn right after these words.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 82, 82. The pick 3, 573, 573. The pick 4 is 4391. The pick 5, 03377. Ball for each of those is 5. Treasure hunt is 3, 7, 15, 22, and 30. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $45,000.
Central Electric Cooperative wants to remind you that safety should not take a holiday this Christmas season. Here are a few tips to consider when planning for this year's festivities. Inspect electrical decorations for damage before use. Do not overload electrical outlets. Switch to LED decorations that use less energy while offering greater safety. Keep live trees fresh by watering daily. Protect cords from damage by never placing under carpets or securing with staples. Unplug all decorations before leaving the house or going to sleep. Keep a safe distance from your home's overhead electrical service when hanging decorations. Do not place decorations on utility poles. This is a danger to you and to our linemen. Central Electric Cooperative wishes everyone a safe and blessed holiday with family and friends. This is Laura Hensley with Central Electric Cooperative. Our tradition is to service, our responsibility is to safety. Central Electric Cooperative is an equal opportunity provider and employer.
Welcome back. A few minutes left to chat with our guest from Butler County Community College. There is an upcoming EMS open house. In fact, it is Tuesday of next week. Are we talking about Emergency Medical Services here, EMS, or is that some other acronym?
Yes, it is. It's Emergency Medical Services. Mm-hmm. And at that open house, students can come and speak to instructors and learn about the programs and kind of get a feel for the equipment, see the equipment. Those programs are for our EMT programs, mm-hmm. Which is Emergency Medical Technician. And there are both a classroom training and also a hybrid training for EMT, which is new. And these programs, and, you know, as we wrap up our credit semester and things are coming to a close with finals, that program is really, and that area is really gearing up because you have to be registered by the first week in January to start those programs. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of trying to get students in the pipeline now if they're interested in that in EMT.
You just go to the open house, have to register in advance or anything like that?
If you go to bc3.edu/EMS, there is an RSVP form there, and you can sign up to receive more information about the programs.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget the lifelong learning classes. Yeah. I just got my brochure in the mail a week or so ago, I think.
Yep, those start up in January, too, and we have lifelong learning in Butler, Cranberry, and then in our Lawrence and Mercer location as well.
It really speaks to the diversity of the community's college, not just the credit, but the EMS, the public safety, the lifelong learning. And also from a revenue point of view, while the bulk of the revenue comes in from the credit side, of course, it is a way to diversify the revenue that we have coming in. So we're proud of these classes.
Let's talk a little bit about athletics as we wrap up our conversation here today. And there was some good stuff. Butler County Community College Pioneer Golf Team won the WPCC Championship again. For as long as I can remember, BC3 has had an incredible golf program. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, almost year in and year out, you know, right up there at the top.
And while this pains me, jokingly, of course, Coach Bill Miller, a very close personal friend of mine, has done an incredible job. Just an incredible job. He was assisted by Chuck Dunaway.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was said jokingly. Bill Miller has done a phenomenal job. We were 15-3 this year and have that 10th championship. And another great coach that we have is Coach Rob Snyder, our women's volleyball team. That's something. So if I started in the college in 99, Rob started around then. We're consistently, year in, year out, successful in women's volleyball. 10th winning season, 19-7, and ended up with the NJCAA championship. And we participated in the state and also had the state conference championship.
And that is an area, you know, a lot of the four-year schools, women's volleyball has really exploded in popularity. And a lot of the four-year schools are taking the cream of the crop, high school volleyball players. So I think it's incredible that the BC3 Pioneer women did so well.
Yeah, we have the cream of the crop for sure. Mackenzie Craig, she's a volleyball setter. She just became an All-American, and that's the fourth athlete in 2 years to become an All-American. And then she's also a forward on the women's basketball team and is over 118 points away from breaking the career scoring record at the college.
Wow.
So she's excelling in both areas.
Make a note never to go shooting hoops with Mackenzie or playing volleyball against her.
Or it looks like Joel Stutz also, and he's a shooting guard on our men's basketball team. He leads players on all 104 of the NJCAA Division III teams, averaging 31.2 points per game.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Athletics very much a part of the college experience. I think especially at a school, you know, BC3 is not a residential school. Nobody
right.
lives on campus. So you need some things to develop esprit de corps, a pride, you know, in going to school there. And I think athletics is, to me at least, it's a big part of that.
Yeah, and we have a great history, you know. Dates back to John Stuper as an example for our baseball team who pitched in the World Series for the Cardinals. Mm-hmm. We've had students who have transferred to D1 and D2 schools. And I think us being from Western Pennsylvania, sports, you know, dating back to when the immigrants came from the old country, what have you, sports was a way out. That tradition continues here with the involvement of our student athletes on the BC3 athletic teams.
Butler County Community College President Dr. Nick Neupower visiting with us here today, along with Jess Matnock. She's the Executive Director of Communications and Marketing. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas to the both of you.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice to have you here today.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Reminder, program note, we have Knock Boys basketball tonight on WISR. We had Penguin hockey last night. Not so good.
Yeah.
I worried about that game. The Chicago Blackhawks are a lousy team this year, but they had lost 8 games in a row. And I thought, oh, boy, now the Penguins have to play them. Wouldn't you know? Anyway, the Pens play again tomorrow night, by the way, hosting the Boston Bruins. So we have a lot of sports coming up here on WISR over the next couple of nights. News coming up next. I'm Dave Malarkey. You're listening to WISR 680 in Butler.
This is your station for Pittsburgh Penguins hockey.